speech by Professor Steve Fuller. The title of his presentation is Does the Distinction Between the Social and Natural Sciences Make Sense in the 21st Century? Professor Steve Fuller holds the August Kohn Chair in Social Epistemology in the Department of Sociology in the University of Warwick. He is most closely associated with the research program of social epistemology. Originally trained in history and philosophy of science, he is the founder of the research program of social epistemology. It is the name of a quarterly journal he founded with Taylor and Francis in 1987, as well as the title of one of his first books. Professor Fuller was a UK partner for a Ford Foundation project on the future of higher education, also a UK partner for an EU FP6 project on the knowledge politics of converging technologies, a social science perspective, and principal investigator for an ESRC project on mimetic factors on individual behavior. Professor Fuller has organized two global cyber conferences for the UK's Economic and Social Research Council, one on the public understanding of science and another on peer review in the social sciences. He has spoken in 30 countries, often keynoting professional academic conferences, and has been a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts since 1995. Without further ado, I would like to invite Professor Fuller, please.
Help you.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Okay, you'll hold on to that. Yeah.
Trap.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Well, first of all, it's a real pleasure to be here. At least from where I'm from in the United Kingdom, this university is known as sort of the MIT of the Middle East. And from the rankings, it looks like you justify that kind of privilege. But what I want to talk about today, I think, is an issue that kind of goes beyond just a focus on technology, but has to do with very fundamental issues that I think any university needs to be thinking about in terms of how it organizes what the pursuit of knowledge is for. And this goes back to very fundamental ideas about what it is to be a human being in the 21st century. As was indicated, the title of my talk has to do with whether the distinction between the natural and social sciences matters anymore. Okay, and so the question arises, first of all, why did we have such a distinction in the first place? And second of all, why might people think that it no longer matters? And this has been an issue that's been very much part of my work from the very time that I've sort of moved from philosophy into sociology, because some of you may know I'm originally trained as a historian and philosopher of science, but when I moved to the UK in 1994, I suddenly became a sociologist, and that has a lot to do with the way in which disciplines are defined differently in different countries. And so it then becomes very important to think about what exactly are you standing for when you stand for the social sciences as something different from the natural sciences. And I guess the basic point that I want to make at the outset is that what's at stake is not something that's very obvious just looking from the history of those fields. Okay? So in other words, what I want to say is that the distinction between the natural and social sciences is something that, in a sense, if you want to defend it, has to be defended on normative grounds. It's a principled distinction. It's not a distinction that's so obvious from the history, because the histories of both the natural and the social sciences are quite mixed in terms of its combination of interests and ideas and methods and so forth that might be seen as part of one or the other. So, for example, just take a look at the history of biology, for example. The history of biology has by no means been exclusively about non-human creatures, right? The history of biology has been very much about human beings, but not in the way in which we normally think about human beings in the social sciences. Okay? So the point here is that the history of the sciences doesn't make any kind of obvious distinction between the natural and social sciences. So therefore, it's a normative issue. That is to say, there's a certain sense in which we want to make this distinction because perhaps of a certain kind of idea that we have of what a human being is or what a human being should be. And so that's my starting point. And I think that this idea is being challenged in ways that it hasn't been challenged in the past. And I think that in effect, one way of thinking about what the 21st century will be about is in terms of a battle over what it means to be human and whether being human matters. Right? Does it matter to be human? And now you might say, well, what else could matter? Okay? Well, one might say that what matters is to be living. Right? And if living is the primary value around which we want to organize our knowledge systems, then human beings are just a part of that. They are not the central part of that. They are just a part of it because, as you know, we have all sorts of other living creatures out there, all vying for space on the planet, etc., etc. And humans are just one among those. Right? And so if the primary value is living, and if that's what matters, right, then you get a somewhat different picture from the idea that being human is what matters the most, okay? I'm just flagging that up at the moment because I think there are, as it were, real alternatives on the table for the human mattering. This is not just a kind of rhetorical question. I think there's a real issue here. So what I want to do, before we get to that part of the discussion, is I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about how this distinction, this privileging of the human took place in the first place. Okay, the first thing I think that should be said is that in the beginning, and you know, you can put the beginning wherever you wish. You might say it's the beginning of the Abrahamic religions. It's the beginning of the university. It's maybe ancient Athens, whatever. In the beginning, when the human was privileged, it wasn't all humans. Okay. The idea was that you might say that Homo sapiens, the biological creature that embodies humanity, always had a kind of potential to be human, but not all Homo sapiens were in fact human. And in fact, there were maybe not all Homo sapiens could reasonably be made human. Okay? So the idea here is that human was a very special quality that certainly Homo sapiens had, but it didn't follow that all of them had it or had it naturally. And so this is where one starts to think about how do you make up the difference, as it were, between the biological capacity of Homo sapiens and being an actual human being. And of course, the answer to this question historically has been education. Right? That's the historical answer to the question. In the future, it might be gene therapy, who knows? But the point is, historically, the answer has been education. The idea then becomes, who is eligible, on what grounds, and what should be the content of this education that actually brings Homo sapiens up to the level of being human. Now, the Greeks had a very particular way of dealing with this matter. And basically, you were human if you were fit to participate in public affairs, right? If you could be in the polis. And so this meant that you had to have certain kinds of language skills, basically, right? Rhetorical skills, being able to speak for yourself, to have authority. But of course, that kind of view, that kind of skill was typically associated with having been someone who came from the right background. And the right background usually means the right family, and it usually means having a certain amount of property that constitutes Athens, right? So you're one of the great property holders of the city, basically. Now, one of the interesting things that starts to happen in the period that we call the classical period of Athens is that you start getting people coming on the scene, the people that we normally call the sophists, who say, well, actually, you don't need to have that background. We can kind of teach anyone those skills, whereby you can speak for yourself and defend yourself and stand up for yourself and so forth, and you don't need to have come from a certain kind of background. And of course, if you read Plato's dialogues, you realize that's an incredibly controversial position. But that's where we start to move in the direction of the kind of worldview that the modern period has been about, which has been about basically extending these kinds of skills that enable people to stand up and defend for themselves in public forums. Okay? It begins at that point. It takes a long time for it to happen. Another issue has to be put on the table first. And this is where, in fact, the Abrahamic traditions make a big difference. Namely, the idea that human beings are all descended of the same God in whose image and likeness they were created. This is a very important part of the equation. Because then what this does is, it not only makes all human beings equally valuable, but also, as it were, empowers them all. Right? Because it's possible that you can imagine a worldview where all human beings are treated as equal, but they're somehow subordinated to some kind of generic life force or cosmic force that bears no relationship to them. But this is not what we're talking about here with the Abrahamic religions. We're talking about human beings actually having a privileged connection to God, who is the being behind everything. So that then is not only a view about equality, but it's a view about empowerment. This is very important. Okay? And I'm laying all this on the table here because it begins to give you a sense of the kind of normative, metaphysical view about human beings that you have to have that goes beyond just the biological Homo sapiens in order to have this kind of full-blown notion of humanity that people have been defending and dying for and promoting, you know, at least for the last 250 years in the modern era. Okay, this has been a very hard-fought kind of thing. Now, the social sciences are relevant to this kind of project because the social sciences historically, are the fields that come into being, on the one hand, not just to distinguish themselves from the natural sciences. I think that part of it, in a way, gets overplayed a little bit in these discussions. But I think the key point here is how does the social sciences distinguish themselves from the humanities? The fields that we call the humanities, which on the surface look like they're concerned about the human, historically speaking, have been about only elite humans. Ones who have access to writing, and not just any old writing, but writing important works, or doing important things, leaving artifacts that people then take forward and regard as a kind of collective legacy, right? So philosophy and literature and history, and in the realm of politics, we talk about treaties and, you know, constitutions and all these kinds of written things. And this is the mark of, and so within the humanities, this is what the human is, right? The human is a being who leaves these kinds of artifacts. But this is, of course, not most of the Homo sapiens who are eligible to become human on the kind of picture I was talking about. And this is where the social sciences become very important historically as what we might call an emancipatory force for the human condition. Because it's the social sciences that actually begin to give voice in a systematic way to the kinds of people who would not normally be invested with the capacities to write the long books and, you know, do the great works of art and the musical scores and all the rest of it, for whatever reason, that would not be how they live. Okay? So what we're talking about in the social sciences, in terms of realizing this much fuller sense of humanity, is something that I think we most clearly see in terms of the methodologies of the social sciences. So if you look at it, and I mean both the qualitative and the quantitative side of this. So let's start with the quantitative side, of course, the idea that you actually are interested in counting everyone with everyone equaling one. Right? So whether you're doing population census or you're doing voting, right, or some kind of survey, right? You count what people think about various things, what their attitudes are towards various things, whatever the issue is. The distinctive thing about this way of going about getting knowledge is the fact that each person counts as one. Okay, that's a very profound kind of move from a metaphysical standpoint. That is one way of respecting the fundamental equality of human beings. Okay? It might not be everybody's favorite way of doing it, but it's certainly one way of doing it. And democracy is very much predicated on that idea. But of course, qualitatively, one of the things that you see, and this is where, you know, methods like ethnography and so forth differ from the more traditional humanistic methods, you know, because if you think about what the humanistic methods are, they're primarily reading manuscripts, maybe going to the original archives, things of that kind. But when you start to get the ethnographic method brought into play, right, the evidence that you are trying to get about human beings is about how they live their lives, what they think spontaneously. And the sorts of human beings that you're encountering when you do this are usually not the most elite people. They're usually ordinary people. In fact, there's a value placed on getting ordinary people involved. And then your social science is sort of built on the back of this, right? And you get some kind of picture of humanity that way. And so this is a very, in the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, you cannot underestimate the extent to which the social sciences in this sense has been very much empowering for the human condition. Okay, I mean, Marxism in a way is the easiest way to make this point, but of course all the other movements, whether we're talking about, you know, feminism or post-colonialism or anti-racism or whatever, all of these movements are on the back of this form of knowledge. But all along, this form of knowledge has presupposed that there is a strong distinction between humans and other creatures. Okay, so this kind of view of the social sciences that I've been presenting has been one that has you know, still accepted a kind of privileged view for the human. And now it's at this point that the natural sciences start to be relevant. And in particular, you know, with the rise of Darwinism and the way in which the evolutionary mindset has transformed the way in which we think about the world, it seems to me that this is where the most severe challenges are being posed to the human condition. You know, in terms of thinking that you need a distinctive form of science to study human beings. Now, to get a sense of what I have in mind here, of course, some of you who are some of the older people in the room will recall that back in the 1970s, there was this movement that was initiated by E.O. Wilson, a Harvard ant specialist, called sociobiology. Sociobiology. And so this is the idea, and this is an idea that actually has very strong roots in the history of evolutionary theory, certainly in the ideas of Herbert Spencer in the late 19th century. And it is, in fact, one of the ways in which sociology came into being, but in a sense got marginalized in the 20th century. But the idea being that the kinds of social arrangements that we see in human beings can equally be seen among other animal species. Right? So there's a real open question, you know, so it isn't enough to say, oh, you know, we need social sciences because human beings are the only beings that form societies. This is not true. This is not true. This is not a good reason. Because in fact, all the other animal species have their social orders, and their social orders are quite interesting, quite distinct, and you can see similarities in many cases between what certain species do and what human beings do in various contexts. Nobody denies that. I mean, this is what sociobiology in a way was trying to argue, namely that in a sense, every kind of social formation that has any kind of reliability or stability within the human condition has precedence within the animal kingdom. It's not the same species necessarily. It's not necessarily the case that the apes were doing everything we're now doing. No, that's not the argument. The argument is there's actually precedence from different species with regard to different social activities, and that shouldn't be surprising because all species, right, belong to the same line of common descent. We're all, you know, human beings are descended from the whole animal kingdom, not just from the apes. Apes are just the latest, but we're descended from all the others as well, and our genetic makeup shows that. Right? The overlap in genetic makeup between human beings and other creatures is enormous. So it shouldn't be surprising then, from that standpoint, that human beings have all their social arrangements potentially have precedence in the animal kingdom. Moreover, the animals actually get on with each other very often. There are symbiotic relationships. When we talk about the science of ecology, right, we are typically talking about situations where animals of several species live in a more or less harmonious or at least predictable order with each other that stabilize the environment. Human beings sometimes do this, sometimes they don't do this. But the point is, that might be seen as part of an extended sense of a social order. Right? In other words, a social order doesn't have to be exclusively human. If we think about symbiosis in biology, we can also think about humans as just part of a larger social arrangement, which would then be the province of a sociobiology. Okay, so we go back to this idea. Now, this idea was very controversial at the time it was first proposed in the 1970s, and largely because, I would say, in retrospect, I think this is really clear. It wasn't so clear at the time necessarily, but I think in retrospect, is because of the shadow that World War II cast on this kind of thinking, given the issues of racism with the Nazis and so forth, and genocide and all those kinds of issues, right? That the whole idea of thinking about human beings in biological terms was, in a sense, opening the door to all kinds of political atrocities. And so that, in some sense, one of the things that social scientists ought to do is, at a principled level, close that door. Right? So in other words, by definition, whatever is going to be contained in the social sciences is not going to be biological. It may be something else, but it's not going to be biological. Now, this idea was enshrined, actually, in 1950 by the Statement on Race that was issued by UNESCO under the directorship of Julian Huxley, who is one of the founders of the Neo-Darwinian evolutionary synthesis. So here's a man who's a paid-up evolutionist, in fact, very important in bringing together the natural history perspective and the genetics perspective into the kind of modern-day form of Darwinism that scientists pursue, but nevertheless realized that given the recent Nazi past, that the only way to actually make sure that biology continues without interruption is going to be to declare that race is just a social construct, right? In other words, get rid of the concept of race, you know, in that sense, remove the most natural place in which the relationship between the social and the biological might be made. Remove that from the equation. And then what you have then are these two different disciplines. And the notion of race is just seen as a kind of phantom notion, right? A social construction, where social construction is understood, you know, as this kind of like made up, right? It doesn't really exist. Okay, this was enshrined in 1950, and it was very important, actually, in enabling biological research, including in genetics, to go forward without political interruption. I mean, because you should not underestimate that as a result of the Nuremberg trials that took place, checking out all these Nazi scientists and what they were doing during the World War II, you should not underestimate the amount of sentiment that was present at the time to close down genetics as a field of inquiry altogether. Okay, but Julian Huxley was very much part of this move, a kind of finessing move, you might say, to kind of draw a boundary between the social and the biological so the biologists can continue to do their work, but they wouldn't be allowed to deal with the human stuff. Okay, and this idea, and so when E.O. Wilson publishes Sociobiology in 1975, he is trashed. Totally trashed. In fact, he gives a talk at Harvard, and a student comes from the audience and pours a pitcher of water over his head. Okay? There was just no respect given to this guy. Now, as it turns out, of course, this field continues to live today. It's called evolutionary psychology. We, of course, live in a world where the issues of the biological components of the human condition are much more sophisticated in terms of how we understand them, right? I mean, you would not find a serious biologist today who would adhere to the kind of race categories that were being talked about in the 1930s and 40s in Nazi Germany. You certainly wouldn't find that. But of course, what you do find, and you find a lot of ongoing research on, is particular kinds of genetic and other biological markers of socially salient traits in human beings. And these traits are, from an evolutionary standpoint, hooked up to things that also refer to things that animals have as well. Okay? And this is part of the normal circumstances under which we have science into the human condition today. Interestingly, it seems to me that most of my colleagues in the social sciences, with the exception, I would say, of economics and some parts of psychology, continue to ignore this. If not ignore it, try to criticize it in a way that might have been appropriate in 1950, but isn't really appropriate today. And I think part of the problem here is that one of the ways in which the world's changed since the end of World War II isn't simply that our science has become more sophisticated and we can talk about the biological components of the human condition in a more sophisticated way, but also people's self-understanding of who they are has changed in the interim. Okay? And I'm thinking especially of younger people today, right? So we're in a culture where, in a sense, the whole idea of biomarkers that are being gathered by various means, either voluntarily or involuntarily, perhaps by certain declarations on the internet and so forth, is kind of getting to be second nature. So these kinds of distinctions that in the past were very clear to be able to make at a principled level between the social and the biological are not so easy to make anymore, okay? And now if you add on top of that something that I alluded to at the beginning of this talk, namely that you have this kind of growing awareness that the locus of relevance for value in the world isn't just the human, but is some sort of more general notion of the living, right? Then the motivation for drawing a strong distinction between the social and the biological starts to break down as well. Okay, and again, what adds momentum to this view is, of course, all of the concerns about global warming, right? Because if you look at so there's a scientific consensus saying that the overall population of the planet is going up by a couple of degrees centigrade, which in the long term will lead to enormous ecological disaster. And when one thinks about that problem, right, the problem is, you know, not just that it will inconvenience humans, but it will actually destroy a lot of the human population and a lot of other animal species as well. And one of the lessons of that kind of disaster would be that human beings just did not realize how much they depend upon other living beings in order to maintain their own lives. Okay, I'm not saying I endorse this whole story. In fact, I actually am more skeptical of it than you might think. But nevertheless, I do think that it is this kind of trajectory that I've been just laying out here that has started, you know, in the 1970s with sociobiology, has moved into evolutionary psychology, has taken in this idea that there's a wider range of value relevance than just the human, and encompasses this current problem of global warming. I think this, in a way, is challenging very much kind of the idea that one can talk about the autonomy of social sciences from the natural sciences. Okay? So in a sense, what I'm trying to do in this talk is to kind of lay the challenge down in as strong a way as possible. Because I am someone who actually believes that the social sciences should remain distinct, because it's only going to be by having the social sciences that we're actually going to get an articulated notion of responsibility, okay, of going forward. Okay, because one of the things that is very striking about a lot of the stuff that we hear about global warming is that there is a kind of a fatalism about this, okay? So a lot of the people who believe that human beings are nothing more than just another animal species, and that eventually we'll become extinct, and that global warming may be the first moment in that, whatever. There is a tendency to think that from a human standpoint, the only appropriate attitude is fatalism, in the sense that human beings cannot possibly control enough of the situation to be able to reverse or to mitigate what's going on. And it's this opposition to fatalism, right, that the social sciences has always been very much in favor of, right? Social sciences have opposed all forms of fatalism. I mean, and this is one of the things that I think, you know, if you want to talk about what is a great lesson of the Marxism, I believe, is as a political movement, is a spent force. I don't believe Marxism is going to be resurrected in this century at all. But one of the things that I think is very important about the history of Marxism that we should not lose is the fact that this was a movement that very much believed in the power of people to take control of their situation and to determine their destiny. And they can do it by collective means. And it seems to me that as long as the social sciences keep that kind of ideal in view, there will be a way of being able to define itself that doesn't just enable the social to be reabsorbed into the natural, which is what I think is happening at the moment, even among the most well-educated and well-meaning people around. So I've been talking, I think, for about a half hour. What I'll do is I'll stop here, because in a sense I want to put a challenge for you to think about, because in a sense, the usual ways in which we think about the distinction between the natural and the social sciences, you know, from the 19th century, some of you who teach philosophy will know about this, of course. I don't think those things are really all that relevant anymore, but I do think there is this challenge that's kind of on the table about the basically the faith in human beings to take collective control of their destiny and in a way not simply be absorbed as part of nature, but to reassert a kind of control over nature in a positive way. I don't mean this, but in a positive way. And this seems to me to be where the social sciences historically has distinguished itself from the natural sciences in the past. And this is the challenge that I think is before us today. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
Should I sit down? Thank you very much, Steve.
Would you like to take questions?
Sure, sure.
I mean, we don't have much time, but if there are
yes,
any questions.
Yes, I'll take some questions, no problem.
Steve will be actually speaking at philosophy department in the afternoon as well, so those of you who are interested in his work can also attend to that lecture organized together with the sociology department. But if you have questions right now, we may have some questions. If not, please.
Mm. Thank you for the talk. My name is Ataman. I am a chemist. I was encouraged by the fact that you mentioned Marxism. And now we are living in a general economical system where spending is idolized very much. So if you spend more, you are more human. Well, what do you think about this? You didn't mention, you avoided talking about this type of ideas.
Well, I did.
Can I lure you into this?
Yeah, I wasn't intending to talk about it. That's why I didn't talk about it. I mean, my general view is that, first of all, I don't think capitalism is going to disappear. And I don't think, in a sense, even if you look at Marxism, Marxism was basically about socializing the forces of production that capitalism had produced. So in a sense, capitalism, I do think, I mean, even if you follow a Marxist line, at some level is here to stay. The question is the volatility that capitalism produces. But the idea of that we live by consuming, what you just mentioned there, I think that refers to a different kind of issue. And that's an issue that I think isn't going to go away either. And that's basically the idea that we are leaving more traces more publicly about what in the past would have been called our private lives, okay? And so issues having to do with big data and all that kind of stuff, I think that's an emerging, very important, significant issue, okay? Much to my mind, I think that's a much more important kind of long-term issue in terms of defining humanity than the sort of financial fluctuations that we've been seeing over the past few decades. And so one of the things that I've been working on most recently, because I've had a lot of contact with the guys in Silicon Valley, and if you know, in terms of this issue, the Silicon Valley worldview basically is privacy is a thing of the past, get over it, right? What you want is not surveillance, but covalence, right? So I look at your data, I look at your consumption patterns, you look at mine, and the only question is whether I am disadvantaged by your looking at my data, not whether you have access to my data. Of course you have access to my data. The question is whether I suffer as a consequence of your having access to my data, okay? And that's the idea of covalence. I actually think this is a very important development in the long term in terms of how people think about their responsibility to each other, what the difference is between the self and the other, and so forth. And I think that's the long-term issue, right, which goes beyond the financial issues that a lot of people have been focusing on recently. There's this kind of deeper issue about how we define our self-identity. I hope that's sufficiently clear for these purposes.
Well, okay, thank you.
That's it? Okay.